Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
We are burning down the house here on the Heritage, the one and only HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. As you know, if you've listened to a few of these programs, we talk a lot about architecture and the creative arts. In the beginning, from the very beginning, I have had the stated and I think understood mission statement of trying to raise the level of discourse about architecture and the impact that we architects make on the built environment and making that accessible to those of you who are either engaged in this glorious battle to give form to chaos or those of you who are interested in the sorts of conversations that we, the designers, have between and amongst ourselves. And to that end, we welcome back architect and writer Duo Dickinson. Are you there, Duo?
I am there. I am here. You are there. And I am glad that we are connected.
Through the wonders of telecommunication, Duo is joining us here in the studio in Brooklyn from his lofty retreat in Madison, Connecticut.
I am in downtown, gritty New Haven, Connecticut today.
Oh, my God. I hope you're wearing your body armor.
I think it's called tweed.
Ah, always good. Always good. Duo has been with us frequently talking about this and that item that irks him or me or us in the world of architecture. But the seed for this particular conversation is Duo's new book, which will publish. When will it hit the bookshelves?
Well, the great thing about publishing now is that the frauds of previous generations are now completely out in the bright light of disclosure. You know, it used to be that they would talk about a book's release date. Well, the book has been available now for about a week on Amazon.com, but it doesn't hit bookstores until November 15th. But they print a zillion of them in some foreign land, and they're available pretty quickly.
Well, Duo's book is called Staying Put, Remodel Your House to Get the Home You Want, published by Taunton Press from Newtown, Connecticut. What a tiny little place, Newtown. In no particular order, these are the things that I'd like to talk with you about today. One, how did you get Kurt Anderson of Studio 360 to write a pre-publication blurb for you? That is, to my mind, super hot. I'm sure you feel the same. Two, this is your seventh book, I understand.
Yes.
How did you get into writing books? I want to go through a few of the different themes that you have in your book. How you think these might be scalable to people who are not particularly doing single-family housing, but might be working on larger structures. Yeah. And also, I want to share some of my own thoughts about what you've written. To give you a couple moments of thought before we launch into it, let's have a musical break of about a minute.
Thank you.
Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network is brought to you this Sunday by the Hearst Ranch. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor. That is so true. I've had some. That's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, go to www.hearstranch, all one word, hearstranch.com. Thank you, Hearst Ranch. We appreciate your support. One of these times we'll get you out here and we'll have some Hearst Ranch beef. It is...
I got to tell you, with that music, it charged my cardiovascular system up so much. Then you top it off with beef and I feel like I could rip through a wall right now.
Excellent. Well, let's talk about ripping down walls and... And expanding, well, as I understand it, the idea for this book, Staying Put by Duo Dickinson, Remodel Your House to Get the Home You Want, is all of a piece with the conflation of the real estate market, where people can no longer move up, trade up, flip. I mean, I even had a landlady whose business was buying houses and flipping them. And she made a very good living for about 5 years. And
that's about the average, 5 years.
And that was all of a piece with the run-up to our current depression.
You know, I got to tell you, the story of this book is the story of the last decade. When I'd written a book called The House You Build about 7 years ago, and that was basically written to essentially challenge an industry which had gotten its... belly quite distended by having so many people want so many houses all at once that the cost of building a house went through the roof. And I wrote a book for people that wanted to build a house for themselves, and I showed them in with about 20 examples that there are ways you can build affordably even in an up market. But then they assigned me to a two-book deal, so the second book was going to be about, interestingly enough, about what people do when they buy houses that they can afford in a building boom, which are typically ranches and capes and other very simple, normative, you know, prototypic, stereotypic designs. You know, what can they do with prototypic, stereotypic designs of houses that were accessible to people with a limited budget in a boom market where, you know, a cape would cost $400,000? Well, that book, like all the other architecture books at Taunton Press, was summarily killed about 3 years ago because they realized that people were not going to buy pretty picture books about houses that cost $45. And they were absolutely correct. But the book that we had started was so great. It was so interesting to look at, you know, prototypic, stereotypic suburban homes with a fresh eye that they came back around to me and said, do you want to try it again? And I said, well, I think the way we would try it this time would be from the opposite side. Not about how do you get into a bustling economy buying undervalued crummy houses, but what happens once you've already done that, the economy tanks, and you can't even begin to think about selling your house anymore, you're left with these prototypic, stereotypic housing types, what the hell do you do with them? And this book basically says, Staying Put basically says, even in the most awful economic situation, even when you've got very little equity, there are moves you can make to soften the edges of a misfit home, either to its site or to you or to both. And design professionals can really help with that, and they can actually give you greater insights than you have. But the central message of the book is also to housing consumers and house homeowners is basically trust your knowledge base, the fact that you know that house better than any designer or builder does in terms of how you use it and how you like to use it, should empower you to talk to designers and builders. Once you've got a certain knowledge base yourself, and you can talk their talk and walk their walk a little bit conceptually, you'll be able to take control of your home. And I think that's a scenario for the last 3 years. People have felt completely out of control of where they live because their property values have just gone through the floor.
Yeah. Well, one of the problems that we face, you know this, is that if you're already underwater, you don't have money to hire an architect. Now, I have to applaud you for using the A word frequently. Yes. Because so many people think, as you point out, well, I just go to my brother-in-law who's a builder.
And build shopping malls, by the way, in Indiana. I think that's the one you want.
Yeah. Although, yes, and in almost every case, you say, see an architect or a licensed professional, which I like. And you do point out the downside of going to a designer who's not licensed, because they just don't have the depth of experience to address the structural, mechanical, electrical issues that come up and can really bite you on the ass if you're only just making pretty pictures and say, well, they'll just work it out in the field.
Well, if you could think the one, you know, and this is like this incredibly dull, tiny, thin silver lining to an otherwise black, gaping maw of a depressive reality of our economy. The one silver lining is, for architects, I think, is that if there was ever a situation where people could understand how fragile the equity is in their biggest investment, their home, and their biggest liability, their home, if they could, people now know how incredibly fragile the tentative balance is between what they owe and what the house is worth, you would desperately hope that if architects can show them, demonstrate to them that they have their best interests at heart economically as well as aesthetically, they could actually say, it's crazy for me to have a 401k that's worth $150,000 with somebody who I pay thousands of dollars every year to manage it, and have a house whose net worth to me could be two or three times that much in several years or several decades, and not pay a licensed professional a few thousand dollars to assess it, massage it, and
exactly.
give you some sense of what the possibilities are.
Yes, and manage it for you or with you.
With you.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
That's the operative thing, with you. And that's something where I've been killing myself for a few decades trying to reform the profession.
Well,
we're not good at playing with people. We're pretty good at sort of, you know, saying, if you don't buy my hype, I'm walking out the door. The truth is, this book basically says to housing consumers, if you know what you want, you can find a licensed professional architect who will listen to you and will help you. And there are builders out there that will listen to you and the architect and will help both of you spend your money better than you would if you didn't have either of them.
Right. For sure. Well, especially in the world of single-family housing, which is what you address four square in your book. And by the way, I think your book is going to be immensely popular because it is accessible.
Well, there's a funny story about this, too, which I think the book is an interesting transitional book. It is a book. Taunton Press, as everybody knows, did the Not So Big House books by Sarah Sosenka that were unbelievably successful. It was on Oprah, did all sorts of stuff because it captured the zeitgeist of the '90s. That was, do I have to live in a McMansion to be happy? I mean, I hate these things. Well, this book, in a way, I hope, captures a little bit of a similar zeitgeist in that people don't want to even think about coffee table books because they have the internet, and people don't even want to think about spending a lot of money on a book that shows them things they can't even begin to fantasize about in this down economy. And I had to convince a press that is a small and wonderful, thoughtful press that we could make a book for under $25 in retail costs, and we all know that on Amazon that means it's $13 or $14, in retail costs, that would be as interesting visually as any website you'd ever want, which meant we overstocked with photographs. There are 300 photographs, some of which are quite small. And there was a meeting with the aesthetes at the press where they said, well, how can we make photographs as small? People won't be able to see them. And I said, yes, they will. I said, well, prove it. So I went to Urban Outfitters, got five books in 2 minutes, all with little tiny pictures about fashion and about makeup and about decorating, and I brought the books in, and they were exactly the same size as this book, a high-quality, heavy-duty paperback book, and I sort of threw those books on the table, and I said, tell me these books aren't selling if they're at Urban Outfitters, and tell me that people don't like looking at little images, thumbnails on websites, and then being able to go see them. And I said, and by the way, if we have a website that goes along with this book, they'll be able to see these little pictures as big as they want.
Right.
And they looked at each other and said, do you want to have a website with a book?
Yeah.
And I went, yeah. So on November 1st, www.stayingput.com will go live on All Saints Day, and everybody could click on it and screw around with it, and you'll see a lot of stuff.
Well, the funny tag that's on the back cover of this sends you to Fine Home Building.
Yes.
Yes. I just recently acquired an Android. I couldn't afford an iPhone. I don't make the big bucks that you make, do I?
Well, my iPhone's 2 years old, so I'm already a loser.
Well, I'm sure that the tag reader works on your iPhone, but it sends you to findhomebuilding.com.
Yes, but, it isn't up yet.
No, Fine Home Building is up there. It's up.
Oh, no, but ultimately it'll go to Staying Put, Doug.
We're
still madly putting together the images. And there was so much stuff from this. And by the way, here's one of these funny coincidences that makes you realize what books are really about. In trying to get the cost down to under $25, we realized that we couldn't go to 30 sites all over the country with a photographer and spend $40,000 or $50,000. We had to find a way to do all the artwork in this for about a quarter of that. What we did was
you shot all the afters.
No, all the befores.
All the befores.
Who shot the afters is one of the great, great photographers in America, Mick Hales. He was one of the great garden photographers in the world, and he and I are just friends, and he shot everything I've done for the since my house in the last 27 years. And we're able to work out a deal where all the images that he had banked over the last, say, 10 years, and all the images that we shot new for the book could all be contained in one photo budget. And that enabled us to offer the book with, you know, almost 300 pages and over 300 photographs for, you know, under $25.
Because
we knew that in this part time of the century, we had to give people an inexpensive, art-filled inspiration book and not some tome saying, oh, by the way, you're screwed. You'll never be able to afford this.
No. You have succeeded. First of all, the paper that it's printed on is got to be 60 pound or better. It's slick.
You got it. Yep, you got it.
And it's perfect bound, which means it won't last forever. But Duo will write other books in the future. And if you really love
it, there's a website.
And there's a website. We don't know how long websites actually last.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Yeah. But if you really love it, you can take it to a binder and have it put in a perfect bound. In a cloth bound cover, which would be kind of funny because this is. Well, here's one of my observations. Because you've got the text that's running through with illustrative photographs, you also have sidebar commentary that's running not parallel, but in some cases a totally different. Theme, which, because I'm of a certain age, reminds me of the movie Woodstock, about the Woodstock Exposition of 1969, where the screen suddenly splits into two separate things happening at the same time.
There you go.
Which I found, was that your intention?
You're just about there. What it was, you're exactly right. And it's actually, if you break it down even further, we decided that what we wanted to do was give the amount of visual stimulation, whether it be pull quotes, sidebars, before and after couplets.
Right.
We wanted basically to have somebody pick this up in a store and say, whoa, I could spend 3 minutes with this, have a lot of fun, and put it down and pick it up again in 3 days and spend three more minutes and have fun with it.
Yeah.
Instead of having to think that it was a study piece, I really wanted to have it have the sort of intellectual spiciness and a variety of platforms of, you know, very quick aphoristic kind of stuff and deep thoughtful stuff and kind of old timey old saws about construction design, so that people could actually get the depth and breadth of what it is to remodel a house, which is not simple.
It's like heart surgery, and you've got captions that write over photographs, which is wonderful, because that's what we as architects do. You know, we'll write over an image. And you've got some plan information, which is very good. I wish that you had more plans, but...
Well, me too, to be honest.
But, you know, I'm an artichoke, so...
Well, it's also budget again, so
yes,
I got as many as they would put in.
Right, and, well, that's good. You know, you fought for the good thing. But it reads like a website. And,
bingo.
Yeah. And
bingo.
There's not a page without a photograph. And there are very few pages where the photo bleeds over the split from one page to the other, but they're not obtrusive, I have to say. They're well done. It's not annoying because it's not splitting down the middle of the sofa. That's, you know, right down smack middle.
There are a couple there that pissed me off, but, you know, 200 out of about 300 or 400 is not so bad.
No, not so bad at all. It's a good thing. I think I'd like to, well, I'm reminded of a saying, I'm running up to another little break because I want to reframe my own thoughts, that my father and my grandfather both emphasized to me in my growing up that the mind can only retain what the rear can endure, which is you can only sit down for so long before you just fall asleep. So let's talk about the format a little bit more. Let's talk about scalability of some of these ideas. Let's talk about where this goes. Let's talk about the Congress of Residential Architecture. So let's hit it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here on the 30th of October 2011 with Duo Dickinson, architect and writer, talking about his new book, which will be available by the time you listen to this podcast. If you're listening live, you can probably pre-order it on Amazon. Staying Put, Remodel Your House to Get the Home You Want, Taunton Press. It's rich, it's dense. It has so many ideas that you can just flip back and forth and just, you know, if you're like into house porn, you know, you'll just be in a state of huge excitement, I'm thinking. Me, I don't have house porn. I live in an apartment now. I got over that.
Apartment porn now. It's good.
Yeah. You know, I have two things hung on my walls now in my new apartment on Amsterdam Avenue. A mirror, sort of like a shrine to me. It's got a little shelf below it where I put tea lights. It's an atmospheric effect. It makes everybody...
Yes.
Can, you know, ladies can check their hair and their makeup. And a 1903 lithograph from the Correspondence School of Chicago, where you traced over these plates to learn how to be a draftsman by tracing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I like that.
And that's all that's up. My daughter says it has a sort of serenity. I say it's just because I can't figure out what to hang where, so all of my frame stuff is just leaning against the wall. I think I just have to move all that
sort
stuff.
Sort of like a sanitarium by neglect?
yeah, well, after the last 3 or 4 years, I kind of need a sanitarium.
Less is more.
Yes, I'm not hanging anything right now is more. I'll get to it. I just have my stuff. Yes. But that's not the... it's not the focus. You focus on where to put your stuff, how to put your stuff. Mudrooms can be hallways. Walls can be fat walls. You can take a wall out and turn it into integrated storage. All kinds of really great, cool stuff.
Which I find 110%
I endorse, and I'm glad you've included all of it into your book.
Well, the one thing about the book, which is also interesting, is it represents a wonderful collaboration between me and the main editor there, Peter Chapman, who, you know, I've written a lot, and I've written, you know, to be honest, I think any legitimate writer, especially a writer who doesn't do it for a living primarily, but is an architect too, you have to admit that most of the time your writing does suck.
Because
you really aren't a great writer if you're drawing pictures all day long. But what Peter Chapman did for me in the previous book, and also all through the last decade, really, or more than a decade, more like 12 years, he has actually reformed me for so many bad habits that we all got in architecture school, for writing to ourselves, basically. You know, literally
yes.
Singing to the choir with, you know, polysyllabic, intentionally obtuse and obscure, arcane, referential, you know, cross-purposes, you know, mumbo-jumbo.
Right.
That... He basically allowed me in the book to actually occasionally drop a little phrase like what architects like to call or what builders like to call.
Yes.
Because the truth is that what the book tries to do is to use a little bit of hip and jivey language and a little bit of irreverence and humor to bring the person in who is, let's face it, you know, there are 80 million homeowners in America, probably 70 million of them are feeling pretty scared, pretty depressed, and also... maybe 20 or 30 million of them who bought their homes in the last decade are feeling pretty abused and pretty much they're victims of this hype machine that made them sell out the next decade or two of their lives for a house they don't like, thinking they were going to hit the jackpot because this upward spiral was going to make them a lot of dough.
Right.
And now they feel like they took out the prom queen to a hot date, and when they woke up, it was, you know, the horse's head in the bed with them, like in the movie. So,
it's not that bad. But you do okay. To that end, you do use the word underpinning, for example. Yes.
Yeah, I do.
yes.
But I couch it. I say that builders like to call underpinning.
Yes, right. Well, Only in one case do you drop the ball and say, on page 46, if you want to do a little selective demo, it's a good idea to talk to a builder about where it's safe to actually see what's behind a wall you're interested in moving. Yeah, well, okay.
Builder. I could say builder or architect. It's true. It's true.
Yeah, you could have just said an architect, because builders shouldn't be... well, actually, they're not qualified to comment on structure.
That's true.
Yeah, well, aside from that, it's a really good read. And
Lincoln, how'd you like the show?
I loved the show. Unfortunately, there was an unfortunate disruption in the second act. Mr. Lincoln liked it up to that point. But let's not go there. Let's not hope that architects are headed the way of President Lincoln. And it need not be that way, because we have our guard up, and we're going to defend our turf, which gets us into discussing the Congress of Residential Architecture, to which you have graciously, repeatedly invited me to your event in Phoenix in November.
More is more, yes.
Yes, more is more. Unfortunately, unless you all want to send me a plane ticket, I respectfully must demur this year, because I'm still climbing out of the economic mayhem that fell upon me personally during the beginning of this current depression. Unlike you, I did not have a constituency of repeat clients.
Yeah, it's true.
And I was, truth be told, nearly destitute.
Well, you and the vast majority of not just architects, but almost everybody in all of the allied trades of residential construction, anyway.
Absolutely.
And what's very bizarre about this particular situation is it was nationwide. I mean, in all the other ones in my lifetime, there was some part of the country you could go to.
Yep.
And like all the other ones before, you know, a year or two would go by and things would start to get better. And now we're looking at something where we know it's not going to be better. A year or two from now, it's not going to be.
No, we're 3 years into it, and it's still not right.
Not close.
No.
And part of you know, you could make a very, I think, conceptually valid argument that a book like this, staying put about is taking advantage of a situation to help people at a time of depression find some sort of optimistic aspect. Well, that is true. But the other thing, which I think is absolutely true, is unlike these last few times, it's not just longer term, and it's also not just national and worldwide. It's also, I think, permanent. I do actually believe that a paradigm shift has happened where people will never in our lifetime look at houses the way they looked at them really for the last three building booms. I mean, the last three building busts before this one, you know, were kind of like a buzzkill at a really great party that maybe, you know, you got a bad bit of vodka in the drink you had and you kind of maybe got sick the next morning, but then you could go to another party and you could feel pretty good. Now I think that people are essentially swearing off drinking that vodka totally and saying, I've got to find another drink. And I think getting to a place where you can actually appreciate the potential in the place you live versus buying it prefab, out of the box, let's go, is much better for our profession. It basically says that if you hire a good person to help you with a crappy house, you'll get a better house than if you simply trade it in for the next bigger, crappier, newer house.
Well said.
And I think the idea that we could take what we have and make it better is probably the greenest thing you could ever do, far greener than any bamboo flooring you'd ever want to buy.
Absolutely.
And I think that the idea of getting back to reality of what really makes people happy, which is what drives any economy, what makes people happy is having the things they're closest to, their food, their clothing, and their shelter, the big three, be coincide with what their values are. And it was so easy, you know, to get clothing because it's not that expensive, and it's pretty easy with food because, well, heck, you know, you can pay a little bit more and get local vore and get organic. But with a house, heck, that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yep.
And now you're telling me I've got to actually spend tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars or more to make it better? Well, here you can actually look in a book, and there are a couple of products for, you know, $1,000 or $2,000. There are a couple of products that are a bunch more than that. There are one or two products that are hundreds of thousands of dollars. But there's everything in between where, if you, let's just say, I would assume that we are talking to a lot of design professionals on this podcast, radio cast.
Oh, yeah.
And my sense is that
tens of thousands.
Wanted, tens, millions, maybe. But anyway,
yeah.
if you want to show people what can be done, this is not a bad object lesson book. I remember that I bought the great Charles Moore book, Place of Houses.
The Place of Houses. It's a wonderful book. Absolutely.
And I would show that to clients. I would say, this is my attitude. This architect, these three architects, Donald Linden, Gerald Allen, and Charles Moore, these three architects embody what I believe, which is that you can make your place in the world yours, but you need an architect. Well, what this does is it goes one step further. Staying put actually says you can use an architect to make this generic, you know, pissing you off house better for you. Mm-hmm. It might not be perfect because you don't have infinite funds, but you can take charge of this if you're empowered by the knowledge in the book and in DIY websites and shelter magazines that can get you up with the lingo and the different systems and technologies and opportunities. You can actually take control of something because the paradigm has shifted, and we're never going to have this leapfrogging, money-making Xerox machine of no-value, high-cash bullshit, baloney, that...
You can say bullshit.
I can, really? Well,
yeah,
well
yeah.
This bullshit that basically destroyed many, many, many people's lives because of the falsity of the premise of this value generator.
No, it's totally bullshit. I mean, my own experience of that was I was living in a tiny cottage in Darien. It was less than 400 square feet usable.
Wow.
And I was renting. I wanted to buy it because I wanted to, which is one of your precepts here. I couldn't go out because of lot line problems,
yep.
But I could go up. And
right.
I wanted to put a second story and turn it into a retro version of a prim little Greek Revival house. It was a totally piece of shit sort of summer cottage shed with a gable. I made an offer to my landlady. I made some comparisons. Cost per square foot, assessed cost per square foot, with other very small houses in Darien. And I came up with a proper price of $389,000. That was my
yep.
offer. Because it was 2005, and
yep.
the spiral had not peaked yet. She said, oh, no, it's on a scant half acre of land. Well, of course, the half acre of land was wedge-shaped and unusable unless you wanted to do a lot of gardening.
But it was, damn it, in Darien.
Yeah, well, right, but it was the smallest house in Darien. So, I wasn't going to go for her stated price of $550,000. I'd be, you know, incredibly underwater at that, you know,
yeah,
right
and
now.
And thank God you didn't.
Well, I wasn't going to do it. The underlying value just wasn't there. But I was not your ordinary buyer, and you know. And after I moved out, and she repaired the roof, which was a tar roof. And when Hurricane Hugo, not Hugo. Anyway, the hurricane that came through in 05 or 06, it rained through the roof and it dropped most of the ceiling in the kitchen. And the latex paint in the bedroom grew teats. Have you seen that? You know, because
I certainly have.
Yes,
it's
yes.
quite disturbing. You think of it as lancing a boil or
yes. Because latex paint is so flexible. Once it cures.
It's flexible. It's quite bizarre.
Yes. Yeah, you could get an 8-inch teat of rainwater that's come through the roof into the chipboard, and it just collects, and you it's like, what do I do? Well, get a big pot and lance it, right. And the and the ceiling fixture above the bed filled up with water.
Perfect.
Yeah, and the light bulb would still run when I turned on the light, but it was underwater. It was like, it's time to move.
And she said, you know, I'm going to charge you more because we have this incredibly exotic underwater light fixture, which is very rare.
Yeah.
Well, and, we also, you think about it, that latex goiter that was hanging up there, that gigantic bladder of, of water, that is a fire suppression feature that you should have actually paid her more.
Yeah, well, so I moved out. She fixed it up. She ripped up the champagne shag carpet and exposed the floors, and she sold it to a pair of veterinarians who paid about $500 for this tiny little house with about 5 feet of closet space, which does.
And hopefully, I'm hoping those veterinarians are listening now and will buy the book so they can actually take the house, which is now worth $273,000,
yeah,
put $20,000 into it, and like the house.
Right, you can call me. I've got plans for what to do with it.
Exactly.
I turned it
into a built-in architect. There you go.
There you go. I doubt it. But it was a sweet little street. You know, you could walk to the train. It was nice. But,
well, that's what...
But yes, that is exactly the point of your book.
Yeah. Well, the biggest thing is that what most people sort of understand, but they don't completely sort of see it starkly, is that the vast majority of homes in America are quote-unquote traditional. And why they're traditional? Because they're familiar shapes and familiar aesthetics that are bankable for spec builders to sell. They typically want to have zero risk, maximum profit. So you end up getting these incredibly bland, incredibly normative homes that are all sitting on specific pieces of dirt that have got features that are good and bad, and are sitting in wonderful, typically wonderful, they're tight and small, wonderful communities that are close to urban centers.
But the plans are generic plans that have no relationship to the actual site, which is a point that you make.
And not only that, but they're also hidebound to centuries-old design criteria, like having a gigantic masonry fireplace in the middle of the room, tiny rooms with tiny windows, because the only source of heat during the little ice age that happened in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the only source of heat was this fireplace, where you were just heated radiantly from the fire itself. So the rooms are tiny, the windows are small, and you've got this giant blob of crap in the middle of your house. That, no wonder people walk into these homes and feel depressed.
Right,
because it doesn't have any relationship to anything other than a lot of dead designers from the 17th century doing something that was very good then, and has nothing to do with them, their site, their life, or anything other than a predictable, time-tested stereotype, which will make a developer, probably in 1957, a fair amount of money.
Right.
And then poorly remodeled in the 70s or 80s by another developer trying to get that three-season room or that designer kitchen to make even more money when they flipped it.
So
people should understand is that their problems, although they're incredibly in their face and they're incredibly problematic in terms of the quantity of money that the house itself represents, if they can actually understand the possibilities and the pitfalls from the basic perspective of an empowered person like an architect, if they can see what an architect can do for them, it will actually not make them feel threatened by the architect, but empowered and liberated by the architect.
I'm glad you feel like I can use
this person to do what I want.
I'm glad you brought that up. One of the things you talk about is taking out walls, and one of the things that builders cannot do any better than we can do, and actually much more poorly because they've not been trained, is determining how the framing of the house actually works and which walls are bearing and which walls are not. It's an art. It is not a science. Unless you do whole-scale demolition, you cannot tell unless you've got access to tools and you can find, high-tech tools. And you can either through thermography or on the lowest scale, a stud finder, using it on joist, trying to find where the nails in the ceiling are fastening the gyp to the rafters or the floor joists, taking out walls, it can be a very perilous thing. And that's something...
That's one of the sidebars of the book. Watch out.
Okay. Yes. And that's a very... That's a very good reason not to just blithely find yourself a residential designer who says, well, they'll just work that out, but rather an architect, because we consider all these things. Yes?
Indeed.
I do want to talk about Cora. Yep. Let's take another break. We'll come back and wrap up with that. Down the house, Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne with Duo Dickinson, architect and writer of Staying Put. Do you feel energized again? Duo.
Great music director. You really are.
Thank you. That's that and the first break was Prokofiev, my man.
He is the bomb.
He's a Soviet American composer of the early 20th century. I was raised by a mother who was very musical, and she was much in thrall of the Russian composers who were our allies in the World War II. And so she played Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and Rimsky-Korsakov for me, and so I just can't get over it.
You know, sometimes music is not frozen. It's just music. It's really good.
Yeah. It's just, it's not frozen, it moves. It moves. It moves us. It informs and directs our thoughts after we listen to it. That was a scherzo from Prokofiev's opera, Three Oranges, for which I...
Oh, I got to tell you, my son is a senior horn performance major at IU. He saw the Three Oranges opera. He just about exploded.
Yeah.
He loved it so much.
It's wonderful. I co-designed an opera set for that for the...
No, really?
Yeah, for the Dutch...
Oh, that's fantastic.
For the Dutch National Opera with my theater instructor, Bob Israel, who was best friends with Phil Glass. And
Yes, I know, gosh, that is incredible. You ought to do a show just on that.
Unfortunately, after I finished being in residence as the collaborator with Bob there in at the Municipal Theater in Amsterdam at Leidse Plein, which is just across the canal from the Rijksmuseum, Bob dropped me like a hot potato, and he's not communicated with me since. Bob, I'm not going to horn in on your business anymore, so, you know, you could be my friend. It's, but we had a great time while it lasted, and it was a great concept which Bob had, which was to make the set be like the courtyard at Borromini's church, Sant'Ivo. But splayed open with a grand staircase up the middle, and I did all of the production drawings for the stage crew at the Dutch National Opera, and they performed that opera in Dutch, and the...
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah, in Dutch translation, and the pit orchestra was the Rotterdam Philharmonic, and it rocked. I got to tell you, it was fantastic. It was one of those things that informed in me a desire to have a greater integration between and among all of the different aspects of the creative arts. Set designers should hang out with architects more, you know?
I think that, you know, that what we really have lost, and it really, we talked about this in other shows, what we really have lost is a synthetic quality that our profession has as the mother of the arts. And I think that one of the great building types that has the most potential for the synthetic benefit of combining humanity and building is the house. And that is really what drove Jeremiah Eck about 30 years ago to create a course at the Harvard Graduate School of Design every summer about houses. And it was packed. And it was packed through recessions and good times and bad times. And architects, by and large, mostly architects, but some homeowners and builders and developers, but mostly architects would come to the course. They would end up all saying, this is, you know, house design is not a stepping stone to doing real buildings. House design is a separate discipline. Designing residences is a unique part of the profession. And that's how the Congress of Residential Architecture came about. Dennis Wedlich, Jeremiah, and I, because Dennis and I would often speak at these things, realized that we had to make a place where residential architects and unlicensed designers and decorators and realtors and builders and anybody involved with residential anything could talk to each other and could essentially make sense of a profession which was viewed as essentially the red-headed stepchild of the architecture world. And I think the success of it is denominated by the fact that we'll have our 7th annual meeting in Phoenix on December 9th in the afternoon. And I think if people go to the website, www.core, and then the word architecture.org, corearchitecture.org, you'll see some stuff about that. And I would ask all the architects that are house architects listening today, if you want to submit 60 words about the future of residential design and architecture in America, any of you, submit them to Curtis. He will forward them on to me, and we will get them at least electronically published and maybe published in a little book we're going to come up with in November.
Well, you have to send that to Magister Arch, MagisterArch, @gmail.com, or info@heritageradionetwork.com.
Exactly.
And I will get it to Duo.
Or call the show sometime, 718-497-2128. I'm sure you'd love to field that call.
Absolutely. Once, Jack, you fix the problem that people call
me. Oh, it's fixed.
It's fixed?
It is. We have a new phone. There's a working voicemail.
Yay. 718-497-2128.
That's 718-497-2128.
Cool. I look forward to call-ins. I love people just interrupting me. It just makes life so much more interesting. No, really. I mean, that's what life in the studio is like. Is it not, Duo?
Totally. And you know what? I think the reason why you and I are buddies and share a common vision is that I think that the older I get, and you and I are both pretty old, and we're probably, you're not, 73, I'm 85, something like that?
No, I'm about 102, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you look very good for 102, by the way. I can tell you, the older I get, the more I am turned on and sort of energized by just the synthetic quality that you're talking about. The fact that music and architecture and family structures and the environment and a site and the economy and materials and everything fall within this gigantic umbrella of architecture, to me, is such a turn-on, and it's such a turn-off to see the sort of huge, glacial, crushing aesthetic regulators of pretense try to winnow out all of the complexities and synergies into some big white lumpy sculpture blob that then says we have to get rid of all of the energizing parts of our culture that make homes in particular, but any building, richer than just the mental masturbation of an architect.
Let's go out on that. Let's just rag on that. This last week, it was announced that the British Sterling Award, which is the Great Britain's annual award for excellence in architecture, which we here in the United States have no equal to. The Pritzker is not exactly that. It's just sort of like Britain's grand attaboy, named in honor of Jim Sterling, who was a wonderful and great synthesizer of everything. And as I say to my young charges, my mentors and my colleagues, everything counts. And I believe that Jim would have subscribed to that, because for him...
Actually, when I saw him talk at Cornell, it's exactly what he says.
Yes.
Everything counts.
Everything counts. Well, this year, the award went to Zaha Hadid, and it is written, I was not there, but it is written that this announcement, which was staged in a sort of Hollywood sort of atmosphere of many people at dinner tables, was it evoked an overwhelming silence.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's hopeful.
Yes, it is, which says that the onanastic sort of approach to building expression, I won't say architectural, because in my mind, Zaha is not an architect. She's a sculptress.
And a good one. I like her sculptures.
Yeah.
They're not necessarily buildings.
No, they're not buildings, to my mind. They're sculptures.
Yeah.
But the Sterling response there in the hall was resounding silence, which I know is an oxymoron. It's,
You know, they say silence can be deafening. And I will tell you this, what you're pulling out of this thing is quite true, that at the end of the day, we've all had our noses rubbed in the myopia of our academies and of the celebrants, the starchitects of those academies.
Yeah.
And if through work like yours and work like the book Staying Put and work like the Congress of Residential Architecture, that we can bring back the music and the life and the complexity that can make architecture mean much more than it does to the vast majority of the people in the world.
Where everything counts. And by the way, people, we're minding everything and we're trying to bring everything into your life. Not just a single statement of a wacky space, but how you live, how we raise the level of discourse about how you live, how we facilitate how you live. That you speak to at a great, great extent in your book, Staying Put, Remodel Your House to Get the Home You Want by Duo Dickinson, published by Taunton Press. You can find it on Amazon right now in November. You will find it in your local bookstore in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Duo. Keep the faith, man.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. This is Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Thank you for listening. Do keep the faith. We'll be back soon with another episode.